Hello and welcome everyone to another episode of the Our Strange Skies podcast. I am your host, Rob Christofferson, and with me, perhaps the most divisive figure in the UFO community, and my good friend and the host of the Mad Scientist podcast, Chris Cox. Well, Chris, it's good to have you back, man.
Thank you, Rob. It's always a pleasure to be back, man. I'm the most, the Triple H of UFO world right now. Just, I'm controversial. People don't know if I'm a good guy. Am I a bad guy? I don't even know if Triple H is still like a good or bad guy now. All I know is that when in the 2000s, when I watched wrestling, I didn't know what to think of him, but you know what, man? It's good times. He's divisive, and I'm divisive too. Triple H!
He's the chief operating officer of the company now, so I think he's a bad guy, but, you know.
I think that does make him a bad guy. Yeah. Jesus Christ. But, it's so interesting.
Yeah, but Chris, you're causing a lot of controversy this week, bud. You made a statement on Twitter. You are leaving the Galileo Project, man. What's going on with that?
I am. People are like, people are acting like I was in any way an important part of the Galileo Project, which is just not true. Like, so as a research affiliate of the Galileo Project, I essentially view my role, or I guess my part of the project basically is just giving public support for everything they were doing and what they were working on. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And I still do support their scientific efforts. I think the science teams are doing a really great job, and I really, really hope that they do well in the future. But as anybody who has followed anything I've ever said or done on UFOs knows, first off, I take very seriously the idea, or I try to take seriously the idea that, figures that get involved in this have a responsibility to the people who make up the community and make up the people who actually like listen to the podcast and do the things with us.
Mm-hmm.
And we wouldn't have a voice or have a role in this field if those people didn't support us and work with us and everything else. So when I join something or when I'm part of an organization, I mean, you know, when I was at MUFON, I do so with pretty strict,
mm-hmm,
ethical and sort of value-based judgments surrounding it. You know, yeah. I don't just join stuff because I think it's going to be good for my career or interesting or whatever. Although I hope those things will be true, of course, like any normal human. I also try to hold myself if I go after somebody else for something, like being part of a wacky group of UFO Scooby-Doo people, I expect myself to do the thing I would want those people to do.
Yeah.
So I try not to be hypocritical, and I try to be very transparent, especially in this field that is just full of non-transparency. I try to be very transparent when I leave something, when I join something, what my reasons are, what my reasons aren't, etc. So, yeah, I left the Galileo project officially this week, mostly because I'm just kind of bored of the whole military UFO thing. Mm. You remember when I started getting involved in this stuff in the public space and joining MUFON and, talking with people on podcasts and all that other junk, the only thing that I was – one of the main things I was interested in was the people themselves and why they believed these things, and is there a way for us to bridge the gap between science and believers or skeptics and believers more effectively?
Yeah.
And that was always sort of the driving force for what I thought or why I wanted to be in this. And I guess I've sort of – and another part of it, and we've had discussions about this too, I think that a part of that is sort of a wrong mindset almost that I think a lot of skeptics come into this with, which is the idea that your role as a skeptic should be to convince people to not believe certain things.
Mm-hmm.
That, like, it is morally correct or morally right to believe in science and materialism, and it is immoral or wrong to believe in UFOs and ghosts and Bigfoot and whatever. And I don't think that is true anymore. I don't know if I ever really believed it. I don't think I ever believed that the belief itself was immoral. Otherwise, I would not have started my podcast and talked to people and everything else. But I do think that the misuse of that belief is really easy, and that is immoral.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like using the fact that people believe in UFOs to sell them conference tickets is wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Or that even that itself isn't necessarily wrong if it's done for the right reasons. But I guess exploiting them in bad faith is wrong. So yeah. P.T. Barnum selling people a fake mermaid is clearly, I think, ethically wrong. Even if the people who are there aren't necessarily harmed or want to believe it or whatever. You know, they're being exploited in some way. On the other hand, believing that there's you really have caught a mermaid, you're just wrong then, right? But that's not any kind of moral – there's no moral link there or any moral kind of failure there, in my opinion, I guess. So – we're really off the beaten path now, Rob. We're really getting deep here. So anytime I join an organization, though, what I hope will happen, or one of the things that the reason I've been involved in this is to try and, like, I don't think people should believe exactly everything I believe, because that would be boring. It would not be right. And there's no, I'm not any smarter or better or whatever than anyone else. But I do think that people should call out those who are clearly the P.T. Barnums.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people that are clearly make them up. They're making it up to sell stuff, or there's no good evidence for it or whatever. I do think that those people should be called out. And I also think that the UFO mythology on its own has been used and can be used in really negative ways if we just kind of let it exist on its own in this weird conspiracy theory space that it exists on in the internet.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
So, yeah, so when it comes to, like, the Galileo Project and everything else, I don't know that I can have the critical voice that I think – and I don't mean critical as in, like, important. I mean critical as in, like, critiquing – I don't know that I can critique the mythology of the field in the way that I think is right while still being a part of the Galileo Project. Because I think in some ways the Galileo Project now has become part of that mythology.
I got you.
You know, yep. They've brought on people and they have sort of, they're not, it's sort of the problem of, I view a lot of UFO media figures as lobbyists for the UFO subject. They're pushing their point of view out there to the public to try to gain political power and economic power and everything else because they, you know, and they might really think that looking for UFOs is an important thing, you mm-hmm. know, and some of us would agree with that, maybe. But I think that if that is what is happening, that is not coincident with science. That does not play right or play well with scientific discourse and study.
Yeah.
And so I think that a group like any group that is involved in the subject has a moral responsibility to speak truthfully and plainly to the public about what they view as true and what they view as not true. And that's gotten really muddy. It's gotten really, really muddy.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's a really, the easy answer for why I left Galileo Project or why I said I would leave it or whatever, I'm bored. I'm bored of UFOs. I'm bored of military UFOs. I don't think that there's, I look at this almost like a modern day satanic panic, what we're seeing in the media about the UFO subject.
Yeah.
And if I got involved in this subject because I wanted to know, is there anything real to any of this? The only thing I've walked away with is all of the people at the top are full of shit. And the people at the center of it, the people who have claimed, I have had an experience, I can't explain it, it was scary. Those people are still the only source of good mystery and good information.
Yeah.
I don't know, man. I hope the Galileo Project is successful. Mm-hmm. I really did like talking to a lot of the people that were there. I wasn't an important part, so it's not like me leaving is a huge deal. I didn't expect there to be this amount of interest in me just coming out and being like, I'm leaving this project, you know. I've just always followed my conscience, and it didn't feel right to be part of it anymore.
Yeah, exactly. Your interests don't align. You have a certain standard and certain threshold that you follow, and that's something that I've always respected, because when we were in MUFON doing the IRB and stuff like that, you know, one of the big concerns was John Ventre, and you know, that was a concern up front, and you know, when that concern became, you know, very prevalent, that's when we walked away. So it's completely understandable, man. I mean, you have a certain set of, you know, expectations and morals and values when it comes to this stuff, and that's completely understandable, especially if you want to come at it from a scientific perspective, because it just seems like a lot of the time when people say, well, science should get involved, science should get involved, I don't think a lot of people understand what the science incorporates or what that includes. Like, what is bringing science into a subject like that? What does that look like? And I don't think a lot of people understand that. I think they have this kind of notion in their head that it's, you know, contained to soil samples or something like that. But I think expectation when it comes to science is definitely different than the actual reality when it comes to the table with a project like that, or, you know, a project like Skyhub or something like that, you know?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you can't do science in this field without, like, you know, imagine you were building a, you know, I always like to do kind of extreme examples for myself, because I think the constraints that they give and kind of the, you know, the wackiness can kind of sometimes help you see things in a different, more creative way than you would if you were just looking at it as the baseline level of stuff, mm-hmm. you know? And so I sort of thought to myself, well, okay, what if there was a Harvard think tank that was looking for witches?
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
Would I get involved in that just because it was through Harvard? Would I trust that just because it was through Harvard?
Right.
If they brought on people that were like the head witch hunters, you know, no, I wouldn't trust that. And there's just as much evidence for witches than there is for military UFO incursions,
mm-hmm.
you know? So would I trust those two, you know, and I mean, that's a little bit facetious. There's more evidence for UFO incursions, of course, or UAP incursions. But for aliens, for the existence of aliens,
right,
there is no more evidence than there is for witches.
Right.
So, you know, I think a lot of people think that being part of groups like this is a good in itself and is something that you should want. But I don't. There are groups already doing research into the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, right? They're called SETI,
right?
And they've been doing great work for decades. There are people doing a lot of that stuff and looking for those techno signatures and everything else. And those groups, I think, do it in a way that is, when the people from SETI go to conferences, even if they're UFO conferences and talk to the UFO public, they are telling them the truth as they see it, as they think it exists,
mm-hmm.
you know, and they're careful not to work with, or not to embrace the sort of mythology side of things, because I think they recognize that there's a difference between the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, which is a worthwhile endeavor and everything else, and throwing gasoline on the dumpster fire that is the UFO subculture.
Mm-hmm.
There's a real difference between those things.
Yeah.
And, you know, one of the major failures, I think, of science and scientists over the last, I mean, God, forever, is the inability to engage with the public in a way that lets them understand exactly what is happening. The reason people don't believe in vaccines, or the reason people don't believe in climate change, or, you know, any number of things, is because they have become cultural issues, not scientific issues.
Mm-hmm.
And I think science just kind of putting its head in the sand and saying, like, well, we can ignore the cultural stuff because, you know, we're science and the truth, the perfectness of science will make it win out over time. Like, I have thousands of years of history to show you that that's wrong.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Galileo himself is evident that that is wrong.
Yeah.
that science doesn't win out over culture always.
No.
And, you know, so it's a really, like you said, it's a much more complicated thing than just saying, you know, I'm going to find evidence of UFOs. Well,
right.
Okay, let's say that an alien landed on the White House lawn. I would argue that a large portion of the UFO-believing public, they would start off by being very excited, but the conspiracy theories would begin immediately.
Mm-hmm.
And another mythology would form around that allowed those same beliefs to propagate.
Yeah.
That's the most interesting part to me. That is what I'm interested in. I'm mm-hmm. interested in the cultural side. So, you know, that's not what Galileo's interested in.
Right.
And that's cool. That's fine. And you know, it's difference of opinion.
The cultural the cultural side is what really drives, you know, the people's interest in this UFO stuff. And that's kind of what we're going to get at today with today's episode, is that we're going to be talking about, like, the early humanoid sightings of the modern UFO age. And by modern UFO age, we're talking like 1947, when Kenneth Arnold had his sighting. That's kind of the signpost, the benchmark of the UFO era that we are in now. It's gone through changes over time, but given that a lot of people look into, you know, past accounts of things and draw whatever they want from that, and that's perfectly fine. You do you in that situation. But in this episode, we'll be focusing on 1947 to about 1954. So, you know, we're talking about aliens today, Chris.
Woo! I love aliens, man.
They're pretty damn great. So, you know, humanoid sightings, sightings of, you know, what people would call aliens, weren't really fast to take off in this subject. And even the two earliest sightings of alien-type beings didn't become more well-known, more prevalent until about the 1960s. But the first humanoid sighting that we have actually occurred 29 days after the Kenneth Arnold sighting in Brazil. So this is an interesting story that it was initially published in like August of 1947, not long after it happened. And it was printed in a larger publication in 1954 known as O Cruzeiro, which in Brazil was the publication that kind of ran the UFO stories for the public for a long time. That's where the Antonio V.S. Boas case was printed in the mid-60s. That's where the Trinidad photos were published, and the Trinidad photos are kind of one of the more famous early sets of UFO photos from Brazil that shows kind of like a very hard to make out Saturn looking object over an island. But the first story here involves a surveyor named Jose C. Higgins and his surveying crew. And they were in the a remote location in southern Brazil, which is interesting because when you read a lot of the UFO accounts that come from Brazil, a lot of them come from the same areas of southern Brazil, Belo Horizonte, São Francisco de Sales, which is where Antonio V.S. Boas had his encounter. There's stories of people being abducted by aliens there. And there's also what they refer to as teleportation cases. You see a lot of these like back in the 60s where basically people talked about seeing a UFO, going on board a UFO, and they were like quote unquote teleported, being dropped off like 1,000 miles away. It's great, man. It's great.
Mm-hmm.
But Higgins, he was crossing a field with some of his staff there, and he hears this high-pitched whistling sound, and it starts to pierce his ears, and that's when Higgins and his co-workers saw this strange circular, quote, airship with protruding edges similar to those of a drug capsule. So automatically, I think people are going to be going to Tic Tacs here. You know, drug capsule, Tic Tacs, it's all the same thing. But it started descending in their direction, and everyone except for Jose just ran for it.
Which is hilarious,
yeah,
by the way.
Yeah, yeah, like, everybody's running away, Jose's just standing there in the middle of this field. UFO lands 150 feet away, and there's Jose, he's just standing there. He starts to approach it, which is another move, you know? And the thing that they mention is that despite the fact that this is 29 days after Kenneth Arnold and everything that was going on in 47, that UFOs probably weren't as well known at this point in Brazil. Like, the news hadn't made it down there yet, which may or may not be true. But Jose approaches this object and he sees like this porthole made of glass, and there's two figures in this object that are just staring at him. A short while later, one of the beings, they turn their back to him, and the sound of a door, he hears it opening, and these three beings emerged, and the description of these things, it doesn't make sense to me.
I love it so much.
Yeah, yeah, so if we're breaking it down, so their bodies were covered in a transparent suit, which looked like it was full of compressed air. So all I can think of is, like the Missy Elliott music video from back in the day or something like that.
Oh, my God.
Like, you can see it, can't you?
You absolutely can see it. Of course you can. Yeah, it's the big puff, what's it? One of those jackets, like the North Face jackets, right? It's one of those. Yeah, yeah, totally.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So, underneath the suit, though, they were wearing shirts, short pants, and sandals.
Well, you gotta be comfy.
Yes.
You can't travel the stars not comfy, right? So, I get it. That's the way I look on an airplane.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
But the thing about their clothes was that they didn't look like, you know, like the normal clothes that you and I wear made out of cloth. They looked like they were made out of colored paper. So, you know, fashion friendly on whatever planet they are from. So on their backs, there was this like metallic box that seemed to be kind of part of the suit. And their heads were large and round. They had short hair. Their eyes were very large. They were round. And, you know, they just kind of like lacked all kind of facial hair. Their legs were abnormally long, putting them at about 7 feet tall. And despite this, they walked with incredible agility. Like, man, these aliens are out there.
They're looking good. Yeah. They're looking good, man. Well, it's... What's so interesting about these early cases is they, this is crazy.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. if you know, this is not at all what we think in our head of what an alien looks like.
No, nope.
These guys sound like they are coming. They sound like they are puppets out of Carnival.
Yeah.
You know, they got these super long spindly legs. They got big ass heads, big eyes, no hair, no eyebrows. They're wearing paper mache, not even paper mache. They're wearing like bright tissue paper clothing,
mm-hmm.
and a big puffy, or it's not necessarily puffy, but a big, you know, like a they have like a shimmer to them because there's this transparent thing around them. They sound like something you'd make in like this, the, you know, kindergarten. You'd make a doll, mm-hmm. and then you'd laminate it.
Yeah. Yeah, this is what that is, exactly. So these beings spoke amongst themselves, and though he couldn't understand them, he did say that their language sounded pleasant, which is always good. You don't want any harsh language with a species that you're meeting for the first time. I completely understand. They formed a triangle around Jose, and one of the beings... had in his hand this kind of like wand type device, and he gestured for Jose to come on board the craft. Jose, though, he had a bunch of questions for these guys. He wanted to know where they came from. So one of the beings took that wand thing and he drew a circle on the ground, and then he drew seven other circles that he had presumed to be planets. The being pointed to the sky, meaning the sun, and he said that, and the word for the sun was apparently Alamo, which, you know, I remember the Alamo now a little more than I used to when I was a kid, so I appreciate that.
I'm sorry. I love that they always have, like, so for some reason, aliens always kind of speak, like, you know, they basically speak English, just a little bit weird.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they're always pointing to like star systems being like McDonald, Burger King, Wendy.
Our capital is right. Happy Meal.
Exactly. Like they're always, you know, McNugget. They're always like kind of sort of speaking English. And like, yeah, if they never, the words for stuff are never like made up, you know, clearly. Like, I can't pronounce it. I don't have the guttural thing or whatever.
Yeah.
It's always just English with a funny accent.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So the being then, he pointed to the seventh circle that he drew, and he called it Orke. So apparently they're from the planet Orke. Jose is just completely terrified at this point, and he pulls out his wallet, and he takes out a picture of his wife, and he shows it to the beings. And they just let him walk away, which is cool. He doesn't want to go to their planet, which, you know... It's got to be a startling experience when they don't speak Portuguese. They don't you can't relate to them at all. So I appreciate that they let him walk away. And Jose, he kind of retreats into the shaded area where he thinks that they can't see him. And kind of like in a fairy tale kind of story, they start to frolic around. They jump up and down until they re-enter their ship. And it just, you know, takes off. It's very fairy tale-esque, very fairy story in a way, just with the way that this story is structured. It seems like something that, you know, a fairy story that you'd hear from Europe or something.
It's again, the gun being similar to a pipe, right? You think about like a magic wand, the colorful clothing and the weird kind of thinness and everything else and whatever. Definitely very similar to a fairy sort of story. The thing I think is always funny too is they drew eight circles,
mm-hmm.
right? And we're supposed to believe that these are some of those sort of what's the word? These are some of those historicity or historical kind of stories or differences that I think are really interesting to stories like this,
mm-hmm.
right? So the aliens seem to suggest, if that's true, they drew eight circles in the ground, and they pointed, they said Alamo is the central one, so that's the sun.
Mm-hmm.
And then they go to the seventh one is Orki, the place that they're from. So they're from Uranus.
Yeah.
You know? Which is where it sounds like Higgins pulled this story from. And I'm just kidding. That was a cheap shot at Jose Higgins. I apologize. I apologize,
Jose
Higgins.
Put some respect on that man's name. He is no longer with us.
You know, they're describing this, like, they're this not being, they're essentially describing this, they're describing the solar system as having only eight planets, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And when did this happen? This happened in 47.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
Pluto was only discovered, or really, like, not discovered, I guess I should say, but Pluto was only defined as a planet in, like, the 1930s.
Mm-hmm.
So, is it possible that Jose Higgins just wasn't up on his, like, astronomy?
Could be.
And so didn't know that there's actually nine objects that you know, circle the star that we have, right? Even though we don't call it a planet anymore.
Or if you're Zechariah Sitchin, there's 10, you know?
Right. So, it's a really interesting thing. Like, it's one of those, what's the word? It's one of those areas of really interesting historical areas, right? The other thing is they tried to get him to go on the ship,
mm-hmm.
right? They landed, they got out of the craft, they kind of talked to him a little bit and everything. That doesn't happen in modern day UFO reports.
No.
Right? Like, they just beam you up. But at this time, and actually a lot of the cases at this time period, the aliens always got out of the ship and were always like, come on, it'll be fun. Like, we got science in there. Like, let's go. Come on, man. It's
right.
going to be wonderful. Come to our planet of naked humanoids.
Yeah, exactly.
And I also think it's funny that the thing that made them go away was his picture of his wife.
they somehow understood, you know?
Yeah. Oh no, we can't do that to him. If he misses dinner, he's in a lot of shit. We can't, we get it, man. Oh, women. Oh, assuming they have like two genders as opposed to as opposed to it being maybe the aliens are super duper.
They're gender fluid. Or
I was gonna say, you know what I mean. They're like, it's just such a funny thing. And yeah, them coming down to being like Alamo, like, you know, it's I don't know. It just sounds like a bad. It sounds like a bad. What's the word? It sounds like a bad acid trip.
Yeah, it kind of does. It definitely does. You know, it just seems like probably someone slipped him maybe some LSD or something, and he had a fun afternoon, you know, some old school MK Ultra kind of stuff. He's just having a weird day.
So one of the websites I went to about this case beforehand, because actually this is one that I had never really, I mean, Rob, you know more UFO history than I could ever hope to even forget. So these are cases that, you know, for some of these are cases I hadn't really even necessarily looked into that hard before or heard of even. And on a website that I went to get this, one of the links, you know how they have like the links at the bottom to like share it to different social media or whatever?
Yep.
One of the links was to share it to LinkedIn. And I'm like, in what universe would I ever want to share this to my LinkedIn profile? Like, hey, everybody, look what I'm doing on the weekend here. This is what I read about, you know. Very interesting. But yeah, I like this one. I think it's so fascinating, and it seems like a little piece of the story, but the shift of the way aliens looked over mm-hmm. time.
Yeah.
Because we don't really get cases like this anymore. You know, we don't get aliens that look like goblins or, that look like giant robotic humanoids that, you know, with claws and whatever, yeah. Or, you know, I mean, we sometimes get like, you know, people say they look like bugs. That's become a new, that started to become a kind of a newer thing in the lexicon today that I've noticed is a lot more reports of people or people will start saying they look like bugs as opposed to looking like the gray aliens.
Yep.
But you know, we don't get these like pinata aliens.
No, we don't.
You know, they're covered in colorful paper. big eyes, big heads, having a great time. Love it.
Yep. Got absolutely thrilled. So, we have another humanoid sighting from 47, and this took place, in August of 47 after Jose's, encounter in, the village of Raveo, which is near, a place called Villa Santina, which, this case is called the, Villa Santina case, I think is what they call it most of the time. But so the witness here, his full name is Rapuzzi Luigi Johannes. So really bringing it with the name here.
Just like a mama used to make.
Absolutely.
Perfect.
Absolutely. Here's the thing. This guy was a well-known painter and a well-known writer in mostly in Italy, but also in Europe. Chris, can you guess what kind of books that he liked to write?
Science fiction?
Absolutely.
Interesting, Rob. Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah, he was well known around this time through Europe for his science fiction stories that would appear, I think, in mostly in collections, but he did write some novels. But yeah, that's the thing about Johannes here is he is well known throughout Italy as a science fiction writer, but we won't judge too harshly just yet. But there's the mythology of this case up front is kind of misleading because you know the Cliff's Notes of the story up front is that Johannes, he was out painting, he sees this UFO land, and these aliens get out, and he waves over to them. They see it as a threatening gesture. They zap him with something, and they steal his easel. The thing was, is that he wasn't painting at the time. He was actually, he was interested in amateur geology, and he actually had, like, a rock pick with him. He had a satchel full of things, and he was headed up. This case took place in August 14th, 1947. So he was heading up this short mountain stream that was called Chiarso, I think is what it's called. I will butcher names all day long. But he basically follows this clump of fir trees, and they eventually emerge onto this rocky riverbank. It's at 50 meters ahead of him once he comes through the trees, he sees this, quote, large lenticular object of a vivid red color. This is the true sport model right here. It's in red. You know it's the sport model. So, you know, he puts on his glasses and he's fully able to discern a disc-shaped object composed of a metal that looks like, you know, kind of the metallic toys of the day. You know, if you saw old school, like, you know, fire trucks and stuff like that, the same type of metal. Even if you watch restoration videos on YouTube, like I do when I need to escape from the world and I just need something calming, it looked similar to that. So it also had this telescoping antenna, similar to what a car has, and it was about 10 meters or 32 feet wide, and it was allegedly embedded into the side of this mountain that he was climbing, which is also another strange feature because it just seems like these aliens are bad drivers. So they crashed into a mountain. So Johannes, he continues upward and he decides he wants a better look. So he sees these two, what he calls boys at the time, that are not that far away. They were very short, and he yells to them, and they start to take these small strides towards him. But the thing is like their hands and arms don't move when they walk, and neither do their heads. at all. So that's definitely a bit off-putting. But they were about 90 centimeters tall, or about 3 feet. And they wore dark blue colored overalls that were kind of transparent, a little transparent. And they had like red collars on them, and their belt was this kind of vivid red color too. And their heads were pretty big. You know, that's a feature of aliens. Their heads, they're generally big, larger than humans. And they have no hair, but they're wearing a brown ski cap. So I think, you know, shit's going to go down right now. That ski cap is an indicator right there. They had really long noses too, which is a fun feature. I enjoy that. They had like small mouths, but they would like open them, and when they did, it reminded him of like a fish, like you know, breathing in, taking in water. And their eyes were enormous. They were yellow, and they had kind of a small pupil to it. So Johannes, he was just kind of standing there, stunned. He didn't really know what to do, but he had his pick with him, and he just started waving them off, you know, trying to get them to, you know, go away. And he started calling to him in what he called an angry voice, and interpreting this as a threatening gesture. And I mean, who wouldn't? I definitely would. One of the beings raised a hand to its belt, and from it a puff of smoke shot out. And this action put Johannes on his ass. Like, he fell backwards. And he said it felt like a violent electrical shock. So I'm picturing that scene in Ghostbusters 2 when Viggo hits him, you know, with that weird blue energy kind of crap. I picture Johannes just, like, laid out like that. It's great.
See, I'm seeing pocket sand.
Oh, man.
I'm seeing the aliens going like, you know, pocket sand, ha cha cha, and then they throw the dust and he falls over because he's very, very concerned about what's going on.
So Johannes, he doesn't have any strength in his limbs, but these beings continue to approach him. He's trying desperately to sit up, and they reach down and they pick up his small pick, and the thing is like it's taller than the being itself, so you know, that's kind of funny. Apparently their hands had 8 fingers, which is a lot. That's excessive, not gonna lie.
Well, what's especially weird about the hands, so they had 8 fingers, but it's 4 fingers. Like, he said that 4 of them were like, 4 of them were basically,
yeah,
thumbs.
Yeah, he had a lot of thumbs.
So he had 4 thumbs and then 4, like, I guess he, yeah. Very, yeah, interesting.
Yeah, very interesting hand morphology here. And so they pick up his rock pick and they return to their craft. And a few minutes later, the craft shoots up out of the rock, which apparently caused like a cascade of stones to fall down into the mountain stream. And the ship initially started to move towards Johannes, and he's, you know, just desperately trying to get up, trying not to be taken by these weird alien beings. But eventually it tips away and it shoots off into the air. And it kind of did it with a blast of wind that accompanied it. So by the time it had departed, it was about 9:14 in the morning, and Johannes claimed that he didn't get his faculties back till about 3 hours later. He was just laying there for a while. And he examined his belongings, and he found that the aliens had stolen not just his rock pick, but an aluminum fork and his lunch. So, you know, this is low. This is high school right now. This is, you know, stealing your lunch money kind of stuff. And new kids at school, this is my horror. This is my terror.
they really got him good.
Yes. So he reaches, he heads back to the town of Raveo, and by 2 p.m., he was just out. He took a big-ass nap, you know. So the next day, he went back to the spot to find his pick. He was hoping in that he was going to find it, because this was a very special pick, and there is a great quote here. Quote, I believe that old pick of mine is now in a museum on some other planet. I hope that somebody up there is trying to decipher the marks cut in the handle, my name and a mountaineering motto, and a pair of stylized alpine flowers and an eagle. And I hope they rack their brains to a standstill trying to make it out. End quote.
What's so interesting is, so have you looked up any of his art?
I've never seen his art.
Okay, so his art is kind of, it's weird. It's like, so first off, all of his UFO art or all of his kind of science fiction art happened after his settings or after his, oh my God, what's the word? After his sighting, okay. Right?
Yep.
So all of it happened afterwards. The stuff he kind of painted before is very, I guess I would call it sort of almost like it's abstract. It's very weird.
Okay.
It's very, very weird, right? So there's one that he did called Dinamismo di un Nudo from 1923 that you can only tell it's a nude because you can kind of see a boob.
Okay. Okay.
You know, and then there's some other ones. So they're very weird. He did one that's very scary. That's like a clown little guy or whatever. He did some. So they're really interesting. But then the ones that he did about like science fiction or whatever, in your head, if you're thinking about like, think about like the cover of pulp fiction magazines, like pulp sci-fi magazines. Mm-hmm. I actually have a couple of them hanging around my house. That's the kind of art he did for the science fiction side of things. And like the stories he wrote are things like, you know, one of them is called like, you know, There Was a Planet. And another one is called like The Revolt of the Joles, who I guess were these alien race that he kind of made up or whatever. It's super interesting how it sort of, you know, colored his whole worldview. But again, if you asked anybody on the street, what does an alien look like? Mm-hmm. They would not tell you that they look colorful.
No.
Gray is the only color that we ever like, gray or green.
Right.
You know, gray or green, not these sort of bright reds and blues and these weird, like these, he basically saw Oompa Loompas.
Yes. Yeah. The very, very much so. Green skinned Oompa Loompas. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
That's what we're dealing with. So, after this incident occurred, actually 2 months after, he moved to the United States for about 5 years. And it was in the United States. He had been there for maybe a month or two. He had learned the story of Kenneth Arnold. And he presumed that, hey, that's what happened to me. That's what I saw. So, after following the UFO saga in the U.S. for 3 years, and after keeping his story to himself, he eventually entrusted it to a couple that, you know, he felt safe with. And, he just spent like 5 years in the U.S. before he ended up going back to Italy. But that, like, these two early stories are just chef's kiss, man. They're beautiful. I love them.
They're very interesting. There's so much. If you were to, one of the common arguments against UFO cases or against UFO stories in the modern day is that there's been so much culture and so much sort of cultural programming around them that what people report, the gray alien with the big eyes and the probes and whatever, that can't be trusted because, you know, so much of it is, again, these sort of cultural, these cultural artifacts that get added in over time. These stories, though, happened before those sort of cultural artifacts about abductions mm-hmm. happened.
Yeah.
And in them, you have sort of bumbling, you know, neither of these aliens were able to actually abduct the person.
No.
We just said no, and they were like, oh, we respect that. Mm-hmm. You know, no means no. Yeah. Like, they just straight up were like, fine. Yo, oh, okay. And, I mean, of course not, right? I mean, in the one case, you have these, like, you know, daddy long leg version aliens. And in the other one, you have Oompa Loompas trying to get you, you know? So it's pretty easy, you'd imagine, for a human a full grown human to say no and then be like, all right, we're not going to mess with these guys. At the same time, you have this coloration that's not this coloration that we don't see today. They're wearing clothes,
yep.
Which is a very weird thing. They don't today don't normally wear clothes, and they have noses.
Yeah.
You know, so much of how they look has changed in the last 60, 70 years. Mm-hmm. It's absolutely fascinating. I love these early cases so much.
Yeah. And this is where we're going to jump to the U.S. because the earliest U.S. case, and it's one that, like, I think got a brief mention in a newspaper or something like that. It occurred on August 19th, 1949, in like probably the worst place that an alien should land, which is in Death Valley. Like, why would you land in Death Valley?
We need some place inhospitable and dry. Yes. We're gonna find one of the few places on Earth where life cannot exist.
Yes, yes. and kind of similar to Johannes here, we got a couple of prospectors. You know, I think these guys were a little more professional, and they see this object crash land. It was a disc-shaped object, and these two short little beings jumped out of the craft, and like we have this like cat and mouse game of these guys chasing these beings through sand dunes until they disappeared, and when they turned around to head back in the direction of the UFO, it had taken off. So like, it's just this kind of weird one-off story because there isn't a lot of description with it. It just almost seems like, you know, a newspaper. Something a newspaper printed one day because they, you know, they just didn't have anything. But the early ones in the United States, until we get to 1952, there's only a couple, and they're kind of devoid of a lot of detail, like with that first one. So there was another sighting in Red Springs, North Carolina, in December of 1951, but a guy named Sam Coley and his two children saw this kind of low hovering disc shaped object, and it had this human shaped occupant inside. So again, another kind of story with little detail to offer up. But in 1952, and we're getting into Flatwoods Monster territory, and we're not going to go deep on this case because it's something that should probably be covered. I should probably cover in a whole episode itself. But like this case, I don't think it had a lot of impact in 1952, largely because of the Washington merry-go-round that was happening at that time. What they dubbed that, the two Washington sightings that had occurred in July over two successive weekends. But like the Flatwoods Monster case is interesting because it seems more science fiction-y than I would say, you know, than these previous two cases where you get short aliens, you got really tall, lanky looking aliens with, you know, paper clothing and just, you know, a very weird details that accompany this. Like the Flatwoods Monster, it looks really fucking scary. Like,
it is. Yeah, it's I'll tell you what, it is one of the few alien / cryptids that I have a t-shirt of, because it is sweet looking.
Yeah.
Yeah. Scary, but very cool.
Yeah.
In my opinion.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Just to cover the basics, September 12th, 1952. We're in the tiny West Virginia town of Flatwoods, and Ed and Freddie May, along with their friend Tommy Hare, all saw like this pulsating red light streak across the sky, and it went down not too far from where they were, and it made it. And one of the boys allegedly heard kind of like a hissing sound, which it definitely makes it seem like a meteor, a close encounter with a meteor, because I've heard people say that, you know, they can hear a hissing sound when a meteor, lands not far, but, you know, pretty close by. So, it kind of has that, that feature going on. The light appeared to go down kind of on a nearby farm. So the brothers alerted their mother, Kathleen May, and there was a National Guard member, Gene Lemon. And together they all headed out into the woods. Lemon leads this group, and he was the first to notice this pair of bright eyes. There's like kind of a discrepancy here because they say red, they also say yellow. It's definitely kind of like one of those weird discrepancies in this case, but this, in like pure science fiction fashion, this monster emerges from this mist, and it is like incredibly tall. The image that they put forth, that they had created for this thing, I mean, it looks like a large mechanical monster.
It's awesome.
Yeah,
it's so cool.
If you've never seen the Flatwoods Monster before, which if you're listening to this podcast, I'm sure you have, but like, it has a spade behind its head. It has these large glowing yellow eyes, metallic arms and hands.
You know what? I've actually always thought it looks like Dracula.
Yeah, right.
Like, because it has this what's the word? It has this very, so it's this, the image is literally of this, like, it has a conical, almost like a skirt, a skirt underneath.
Exactly.
And the skirt, so it looks like it's wearing a cape because you have this, you have these long kind of billowy parts on the bottom, and then those come up, and then there's like this hood over it, right? That comes up in this point, like Rob was saying, like almost like a spade. And behind the hood, then you just have these glowing eyes.
Yeah.
And the arms of it are these like spindly, these spindly little arms with a claw on the end. It's very, very cool.
Yeah.
And very, like, very, very scary. It looks very odd.
Right. And in the artwork, like, look up the original artwork for this thing, because it's floating, and they have a man drawn there in scale, and like, in comparison, this thing's like 10 feet tall or something like that. But
it's crazy tall. Yeah. It is crazy tall. Yeah.
But, you know, it was eventually, Blue Book did investigate this case, but they only investigated the meteor part of it. They didn't investigate, the monster sighting, because like, that wasn't something that, you know, the Air Force really wanted to do. They weren't getting in the alien game per se. They were trying to avoid cases in which humanoids were spotted. But again, we didn't really have that many cases up to this point. And in the United States, we really wouldn't until 1955. Kelly Hopkinsville kind of really sets us in the direction of like, there's aliens everywhere and they all look freaking weird. There's kind of a precursor to this in 1954 in France. So episode 26, I covered the French UFO flap of 1954, and what I love about that those cases is that we're seeing people are saying the same damn thing over and over again. I keep seeing these disc shaped objects and these short beings that are, quote, wearing diving suits, which is a very like archaic thing to see with a UFO. You've got modern technology, and then you've got, I thought you got this little humanoid, in which I thought Jacques Cousteau improved on this model, but I guess we're wrong. I guess the diving suit is in this year. So, but there's one case in 1953 that it's one of my favorite early cases, because it was Gray Barker investigated this case. He flew out to Brush Creek, California himself, and this is over a succession of weekends, a succession of Saturdays, that these short humanoid beings are seen near these two guy, these two gold miners who have a claim nearby. So the one guy's name is John Q. Black, which is kind of funny because it's like John Q. Public here, you know, coming forward with his sighting, and another guy named John Van Allen. And they reported two small figures, pilots of a flying saucer, were visiting this creek near their mining claim. So it was following the second encounter over the second successive weekend that they reported their sighting to Sheriff's Captain Fred Preston. And they described the occupants to the sheriff as a short between 2 and 4.5 feet tall. They were broad-shouldered. They wore something like a parka is what they said. So their arms and legs were covered by a tweed-like garment, which, you know, man, that's probably not where you want to bring a tweed garment is to, you know, a riverbank. But, you know, I guess bring it wherever you want. But this garment was also, like, fastened to their wrists and their ankles, which is another interesting feature.
Rob, they haven't developed buttons yet.
No.
All right.
And I'm sure when they go to the bathroom, they got to just take the whole thing off. It's probably, you know, a complete performance piece every single time that it happens. But it wasn't successive weekends. It was actually the same day from month to month. So the first appearance was on May 20th, and the second appearance was on June 20th. So each time the humanoid beings emerged and they retrieved some water using a, quote, shiny bucket. Okay, cool.
Very advanced, yes, technology.
Very, very advanced. So once the beings were noticed each time, they would re-enter the ship, and they just made a quick exit. And their craft allegedly made a hissing sound as it flew away. You know, it's a similar feature to the Flatwoods Monster case here. This sighting garnered so much attention that the town, well, they, after they notified the sheriff, they decided to return to the site on July 20th. And when they did, the whole bunch of the town, like, word had gotten around about this. So the entire town shows up, and there are people setting up snack stands on this riverbank.
Well, dude, okay, what else are these people supposed to do?
That's fair.
Like, this is, we're talking ball and cup territory for, like, stuff available to do. You know, like, your town is called Brush Creek. You're, you know, besides going to the creek, this alien thing, this is like the carnival coming to town.
Yeah, it truly is. So out there, because apparently John Black asked the sheriff, "Hey, can I bring a gun out there? I want to shoot these things." Okay.
As you do. Yeah. It's the best way to do it.
Yeah. So sheriff said, no, we don't want to create a panic. But when they went out there, there were a bunch of bow hunters that had bows and arrows.
Nice. Yeah. Nice. Let's see your bucket protect you now, aliens.
Bucket.
Stupid science jerks.
Bucket did not protect anybody. So the aliens didn't show up. It was a big bust. And, you know, the townsfolk were disappointed. In Gray Barker's book, They Knew Too Much About Flying Saucers, there is a chapter devoted to this case. And apparently, while he was out there investigating it, he was arrested. Now, this is Gray Barker, so, you know, we're talking, like, you know, a guy who made up some of the stuff that he printed. Definitely, you know, a shady guy in many ways, but apparently he was arrested for investigating this case and wanting to get close to the truth, Chris. And we know when you get close to the truth, you're going to get arrested. You're going to get detained. You're going to be told by some figure that you can't look into this anymore. Stop looking into it. Otherwise, we're going to ice your family, ice your children. You're dead. You're just dead. So
it's funny. You know, I bet if we went to any prison in the country, that's a story we'd hear from a lot of people.
Yeah.
You know, they didn't want me to get to the bottom of exactly what is in these stolen radios. It's a cover-up. Clearly, it's a cover-up!
It's a total cover-up, man. Total cover up. So, despite the fact that France was the star of 1954 in the UFO world, and, you know, to a lesser extent, Italy, it had a mass sighting over a soccer field. So it had that going on. There is one final case that we're going to touch on here, and this is from Coldwater, Kansas in 1954. And this case was investigated by APRO and Coral Lorenzen. A teenager named John J. Swain was returning to the family farm from the fields around 8 p.m. when he saw a small man from approximately 20 feet away. This figure had a very long nose, very long ears, and seemed to fly instead of walk. So Swain witnessed the small man fly towards a saucer-shaped object that was hovering nearby. The man popped into the craft, and it took off at incredible speed. So, like, that's another great early UFOs occupant case, because like really long nose, like just the absurdity of some of the features is so kind of hilarious. Like, it was 8 p.m. I couldn't see well, but I saw this man's huge snots.
Well, yeah, I mean, a lot of these stories have those same kind of things where it's like, well, what do aliens look like? Well, they're probably like humans, but let's just give them one feature that's really crazy. Yeah. You know, so we give them big ears or big eyes or big nose or long legs or, you know, 18 thumbs or whatever. You know, we a lot of these stories kind of add on to this with these, you know, aliens are never. It's actually it's interesting. I had on our show, we had Abel Mendez, Professor Abel Mendez, who's a astrobiologist with SETI. And he actually, I always thought when I heard cases like this, I always was like, well, that's silly that they'd always look humanoid. But his argument actually was, well, if we look like evolutionarily and biologically at species, the humanoid form is the best one for using tools and is one of the most efficient in terms of sort of existing. And, you know, we are able to have big brains and we're able to have, like, you know, hands again to use tools and everything else. And his argument actually was that, like, the human aliens being humanoid is probably true. Mm. Like, he expects that that's what we'd see if they were an intelligent, you know, species.
Yeah.
You know? I don't know what he'd say, though, about 18 thumbs. I'll have to ask
him. It's a lot, you know. Why would they need so many thumbs? You got to ask yourself that question.
A lot of thumb rings. Yeah. Big thumb ring industry in their civilization.
I'm assuming.
That's probably what
yeah,
it is.
Yeah, I'm assuming the mood ring, you know, market is so goddamn big right now down there.
They're huge. Yeah. They're huge on Orky or whatever it was called. Alamo. No, Alamo is the sun.
Yeah, Orke. Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Orke, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, man. So, Chris, what's going on with the Mad Scientist podcast? What do you got coming up over there?
So, we are currently planning our next season, and episodes for that will be releasing in February, beginning of February. Right now, I am actually knee-deep in research on forensic science.
Oh, man.
Because that's going to be a big series that we're doing is on forensics. We have a series on... We have a series on sort of the looking at some urban legends in the places Marie and I grew up with. Mm-hmm. So we talked a little bit about that on the Hometown Horror episodes that were at the end of the last season, but we're looking at some really cool ones. We're doing a weird story on coincidences and specifically coincidences in media and how that leads to things like, you know, like The Simpsons predicting that Trump would be president or all those other kinds of crazy things, right? Yeah. So that'll be really interesting. And yeah, we're just having a great time, man. You know, just living large and living fast, Rob, here in my apartment with two cats.
That is the life, man. That if you want to know what podcasting is, that's Chris has described it to a T. That's what we do.
We're doing great. Yeah. We're doing great. Yeah, no, so if you enjoyed this episode and you like the sound of my voice for whatever reason, check out the Mad Scientist podcast. We're available on all of your podcast listening platforms. We're on YouTube. I play Twitch video games occasionally. And yeah, we're a lot of fun. So the Mad Scientist podcast, check us out.
Yes, definitely go check out the Mad Scientist podcast. It is wonderful. I've been on there a few times, so if you enjoy my voice too, you can find it over there on a few episodes here and there. And if you want to check out all the other stuff that I'm doing, find me on social media, you know, Twitter at your UFO guy, Instagram at your UFO guy. Hit up that link tree in those bios. Special thanks to Floats for the use of their song UFO as the intro and outro to this podcast. I love it so much. Our logo was designed by the great Desdemona. And finally, don't forget to look up, because you never know what you'll find in our strange skies or over a rocky embankment in Italy. In gray, we trust.
Media.